Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. I think you can get started. Tzorim Tovim, those in Israel. Okay, we're in the middle, at least in my, you know, calculation or my Mishnah, fourth chapter, Mishnah Tetvav, Mishnah 15. And we ended up last week, we skipped the middle part, which we'll come back to. We ended up that one should be a zanaf la'arayot. One should be a tail to the lion, as opposed to the head of the fox, as I mentioned. You know, Freddie Potak, 5'5", you know, shortstop, better to be the shortest player in the major league than the tallest player in the minor league. Or to put it more in terms that may relate to us, I think I'm not a real estate agent, but it's better to have the smallest house on a fancy street than the biggest house on a non-fancy street, I think, in terms of market value. I'm not talking about your housing preferences. Anyway, maybe that's not such a great example, but I will point out, the Tosfot Yontif notion, why, in other words, why do we use the imagery of the fox and the lion? So it's probably not so hard. I think we all understand the fox is a sly animal. That's the reputation. I don't exactly know, all the animal ideas, but I assume it's true. I assume it's true, obviously, out in the forest. So the fox is a very sly animal. So one should not be the head of the fox. But what he then goes on to say, and you get this every once in a while in rabbinic literature, where commentaries will say something, and then they'll really talk about the people of their generation, and really often in sharp critique. Like, for example, the Kli Yakar, Rav Ephraim Lunshins, who is the rabbi in Prague. So his commentary, which interested, was printed in the classical Mikra Gedolot. They always printed his commentary. When the Moseta Rav Kook put out sort of their issue, they removed the Kli Yakar and the Orach Chaim. Okay, whatever, different people. That's a whole other. You have to give to an expert on the history of printing, which books get printed. You know, if the reason people study Tosfot, that was the Maharal, who was a little bit before the rabbi in Prague, before the Kli Yakar, a generation or two earlier. So if, the Maharal complained that the printers put Tosfot on the page. Most people should learn Tosfot. It was too complex. Better to learn the Rosh or more simple commentaries. But it's on the page. So everybody learned what's on the page. Anyways, the Kli Yakar, his sole commentary, he was a preacher. He was a rabbi. And basically his commentary is giving Musar to the Jewish people. This week's Parsha, Dei Zahav. Right, the opening line where the Jewish people were all over the place. We don't know, Bar Mulsu, Bar Ava, and Rashi says it's a losing. So he talks about Dei Zahav. The people were very materialistic. All they cared about was their gold. You know, we use it as a homiletic interpretation. Complaining Dei Zahav is not just a reference to the Egel Hazav idolatry, but it's a reference to people worshiping money. Okay, so that's a very common, that's what all Darshanim does. That's what all the Midrash does. We said the Midrash is always interested not in what happened historically, but in what is the relevant limits for today. We'll perhaps discuss this a little bit on Tisha B'Av, when the rabbis give about 15 different reasons why the temple was destroyed. So the most famous one is Sinat Chinam, but that's only one of about, the Gemara in Shabbos has 7 different reasons. The Gemara in Nedarim has a different reason. The Gemara in Bava Metzia has a different reason. Everywhere you turn, there's a different reason, because the rabbis were not talking about the destruction of the temple. The rabbis were talking to the people who they lived with, and they were talking about the sins that they saw in their generation. Anyway, with that little bit of background, the Tosfot Yontif says, so he goes on to complain about all the Jewish leaders and all the rabbis who are not fit to be rabbis. And they're like the foxes. They are gonev dat. That's the term used. Gonev dat is to mislead somebody, to fool somebody. And he quotes how, what a terrible thing this is. He quotes the pasuk in Mishlei, which is, Ki rabim hipila. That's the Gemara uses that to discuss the 3 tears that God cries every day. The tear for the people who should be rabbis but don't become rabbis, or when the rabbi, the Gemara doesn't use the term rabbis, it means higia lahora, people who issue halachic rulings, but we can call it rabbis. People, you know, teachers, people who should have become teachers and don't, that's one cry. Or the even worse cry is for the people who shouldn't become teachers and do, And the third cry is for leaders of the community who exercise too much power, who, you know, are on a ego trip and sort of assert themselves inappropriately over the community. So that, the Talmud says, are the three tears that God cries every day. And they quote a pasuk in Mishlei to back that up, whatever the, that's not as important for us right now. But the Tosfot Yontef says, when he gives this whole attack or speech about the too many rabbis of his time who weren't worthy, you have to know your place. You have to know, you know, today the function of the rabbi, it depends on the shul, but in most shuls, it's not to issue halachic ruling. That's not the job of the rabbi. The rabbis in the Hasidic world, it for sure wasn't their job. Many of the Hasidic leaders were ignorant, might be too strong a word, but it may not be in some cases, but even not ignorant, they weren't learned on the level that they could issue halachic rulings, and that's perfectly fine. That was not the goal, the role of the Hasidic leader, to be a spiritual leader. Same thing in our modern shuls. That's they're different roles. And so everybody has to know their role. It's when you cross the roles. So that's what he was complaining about. And then he says, he writes at the end, after I wrote all this, I discovered in the Rambam that the Rambam says basically the same thing. And when I got tremendous pleasure that my interpretation fits the Rambam. The Rambam lives 1138 to 1204. The Tosfot Yontef is living in the 16th century. So it's a few hundred years later. And he says, I'm very happy. And the Rambam, when he quotes this, actually quotes a verse in Shir HaShirim. Akzulanu shualim shualim knanim mechablim kramim. The foxes that destroyed the vineyards. These little foxes that destroyed the vineyards. So again, could be on a literal sense, but it means the vineyards, the Kerem B'Yavne, the vineyards where we went to learn Torah. That's where we went after the destruction of the temple, right? Kerem B'Yavne. And the vines, and so it's a reference. Grapes is always like the fruit, you know, Bori Pri Agapen. It's a special fruit representing the sweetness of Torah. So these foxes destroy. So that's what he says, that don't be the head of the fox. Don't be, it's, you know, don't join the group of people who aren't worthy and become leader. What I find kind of, it's obvious. I mean, this is, we often have to repeat the obvious. But what I find really interesting is that this Rambam that the Tosfot Yontef quotes is in Hilchot Talmud Torah. It's towards the beginning of the Rambam. And basically what it means is either he had never learned it, he hadn't seen it, I don't know exactly, but I find it very fascinating. You would think somebody, you know, would know the, so I'm going to say it's a basic Rambam. You don't know the Rambam off by heart, but it's not like, wow, I made this great discovery. It's in the Rambam. I assume the Tosfot Yontef read the entire Rambam. He knew the entire Rambam. But so I just find that sort of an interesting comment, that he sort of made his comment and he said, and I later, it's one thing to say, I later discovered it in a manuscript. I discovered it, somebody, you know, around the world wrote the same thing. But to say I later discovered it in the Rambam is just very an interesting comment, and I think a very humble comment. Okay. And of course, a lion, we all know, he kaber ka'ari, that the lion is the symbol, the animal of strength, is the king of the jungle. It's strong. And of course, yes, the lion is ferocious, but a lion also represents, you know, strength. We don't have any, like we have in Pirkei Avot later on, we should be as strong as a lion, as swift as an eagle, as, you know, whatever, the different imageries to animals, that we should take the character of animals. So we don't have anything by a fox. We shouldn't be sly like a fox. We shouldn't be like fox. We should have strength and courage like a lion. And of course, it's really a fascinating thing. The first words in the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Kar, you open up the standard code for the last 400 years of Jewish law, Hikaber Kari Lavodat HaBorei. You should wake up like a lion. I've never seen how a lion actually wakes up. And I'm sure he doesn't mean it literally. I don't know if the second it opens its eyes, it roars. But the idea is with strength and vigor to do the work of God. But okay, that's just to finish up. Last week we should be the, and it's be the tail of the lion. Do not be the head of the fox. Okay, the middle part of the Mishnah. Hevi makdim shalom l'chol adam. This is important, especially Erev Tisha B'Av. You should hevi makdim shalom l'chol adam. You should lahakdim is to go first. You should be the first one to say hello l'chol adam. So again, let's try to see what we can add or just point out in important things we should take note of. So first of all, the Gemara uses this as the praise of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. It's Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai is the hero of Tisha B'Av. We would not be here today for Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. You know, there are certain rabbis who changed the course, and anything. There are certain people who changed the course of history. What their rise, and some are evil and some are wonderful. So you can, you know, who are the 10 rabbis who changed the complete course of Jewish history? So the Baal Shem Tov is one. We're talking for the Hasidic movement. That was a radical revolution that totally changed the nature of Judaism for hundreds of thousands of people. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who of course was, I don't want to discuss, you know, politics, but he would be considered at most center left. Maybe he'd be considered on the far left because he was willing to negotiate Jerusalem away. Not he was willing. He did. According to the plain reading of the Talmud, and it's unimportant if it's literal, the Romans offered him whatever he wanted and he could, and the Talmud criticizes him. The other rabbis, what, are you crazy? The Romans said you could save the temple. Why didn't you do that? But he understood that Jerusalem is only meaningful as the spiritual capital of the Jewish people. There's no point to keeping the sticks and stones of Jerusalem when the rot had infected the Jewish people so much. And he wanted to rebuild Judaism. And he was, he fought. His brother-in-law didn't agree with it. It wasn't an easy position. We know the civil war, you read in Josephus going on, Jews were burning the food of other Jews. So it's Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was really the hero. It's the only reason Judaism survived. And it was his rulings. He, after the destruction of the temple, then in his brilliance, we're giving up Jerusalem. We're not, even if we could save the temple would be meaningless. And then he enacted a series of decrees to relive life in the temple. The most famous probably is that the fact that we take the lulav for all 7 days. We know according to the Torah, you only take the lulav for 7 days in the temple. Outside the temple, lakachdem lachem bayom harishon. You should take only on the first day. And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, we're going to relive the temple experience. Yes, we don't have a temple, but we will one day. And we're not going to only mourn for the temple. That's on Tisha B'Av. We can talk about the mourning for the temple, but we're going to rejoice in what we once had and what we can look forward to. So he made many of these laws. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who literally saved Judaism, So the Talmud says, he knew everything. Talmud also says, I think we discussed this a bit last year. Talmud says he was Hillel. His Rebbe was Hillel, because that's in Pirkei Avot. In the second chapter, when we do the whole history of Torah, we run it through to Hillel and then Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai and then his five students. So the Talmud says that Hillel had 120 students. It's also probably 120 is, I don't say a made up number, but a symbolic number. At 120 students, and the Gemara describes different categories. They say the top student was Yonatan ben Uziel. He was an unbelievable student. I think what the Gemara says, that when a bird would fly overhead, it would get burned up, like the energy, whatever that means. I don't know what that means. And the worst student, the one who did who knew the least, was none other than Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. So halavai, we should be like Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. We pointed out last year that being a leader and being the smartest usually don't go hand in hand. It's the person, everybody knows that. It's the kid, you know, it's the B-minus student who becomes the multimillionaire in business. Not always, but often, a worse way. But it means like that, the talent or leadership, it's not intellectual like prowess. Oh, that's important. So what I was discussing before, the role of a rabbi is not to be the biggest Talmud Chacham. Yes, he has to be learned to a certain degree, but the great rabbis are not the most learned. Often the most learned people can't teach properly, they're not leaders, they're not cut out for leadership roles. So it's interesting that it's the weakest students, so to speak, of Hillel, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who becomes the great leader and the savior of the Jewish people. But anyways, the Gemara rattles off, he knew Tosefta, you know, he knew like everything, Kol HaTorah Kula, is the weakest student, you know, what he knew. And then the Gemara says, yeah, but you know, the greatest thing, Gemara in Brachot says, the greatest thing of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, he used to say hello to everybody. He was Lo Kadam Adam E'olam. Nobody ever got to say good morning before Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. He always said at first, he was always on the lookout. Who's coming? Who's going to say, who can I say hello to and greet? Afilu nochrisha b'shuk, even the non-Jew in the marketplace. Now, maybe in today, that's a politically incorrect statement. But the point of the Gemara, even, and we're going to see in a moment, even to non-Jews, even to idolaters, he would greet them and befriend. We know, and the Mishnah says, so this is just really, Rav Matya, the Cheresh is really just like picking up on the attribute to Talmud. I mean, he didn't know of the Talmud because he's living in the Mishnah. He didn't know of the Gemara, didn't exist, but he knew of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. He's Rav Matya ben Cheresh is a student, I believe, of Rabbi Akiva. So, he's after Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai a couple of generations. So he's picking up on this theme. Now, we know in Rashi points this out in the beginning of Vayikra, the word Adam, whenever the Torah uses the word Adam, it means all of humanity. But of course, God created Adam and Eve, Adam. Adam, min ha-adama. So whenever the Torah says Adam, it refers to the human race. So, for example, the beginning of Vayikra, Adam ki akriv michem, when a person brings a sacrifice, and Rashi quotes, sacrifices, that's not limited to Jews, non-Jews are welcome, right? This is, again, the unfortunately, the politicization of the Temple Mount, non-Jews can't pray, the Muslims are in control, whatever it is, Jews don't have that approach. Jews say, we welcome non-Jews to pray at the temple. It's kind of rather astounding if you think about it. It's quite and especially for the time period it was, it's an extremely liberal quote-unquote view. But it's what the pasuk in Yeshayahu says. We say it on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and the Tzeret Yemei Tshuva all the time in the stichot. We bring our sacrifices to appease on the altar. Ki beiti beitvilah yikarei lecholamim, because my house, the house of the Lord, is a house for a prayer for all people. L'cholamim. So Rashi quotes Adam ki akriv. Anybody can bring a korban. Non-Jews, we welcome them to the temple, and they have their different prayers. They have a different conception of God, perhaps, than we do. But everybody's welcome. Adam always refers to non-Jews. Now the halacha makes a clear distinction. We're not going to give a whole shiur now on relations to non-Jews. It's a fascinating topic. And the history of Christianity, last night, Rachel Slatsky was talking in the shiur Esav, and this week's Parsha, Esav being identified as Rome and then being identified later as Christianity. And clearly attitudes towards Christianity have changed throughout the course of history. Today, we have a much different view than Jews in the Middle Ages had, for good reason. But so the halacha is very clear. On the one hand, you can't eat food that they cook. And if they touch the wine, all these it's very hard to explain these laws to people today, that if a non-Jew touches wine, I don't think we should try to explain it. I don't think it's totally against the culture of today. What am I supposed to say? That if a non-Jew touches wine, but believe me, if it wasn't for the halacha that a non-Jew, I would have no problem with a non-Jew touching wine. I don't think I'm going to marry their daughter because they touch wine. But at the time, I don't mean to make fun of what the rabbi said, but it came from a totally different cultural worldview. And wine, it's true. There's a difference. In other words, that's the extension, the touching. It shouldn't matter. There are some halakhic discussions about that, how far we carry that, not for now. But yes, obviously going drinking wine is very different. That problem exists even more today. The intermarriage rate is so high. But the halakha has very strict social barriers between Jews and non-Jews. And because the Torah was very afraid of intermarriage and following the ways of the Gentile. On the other hand, when it comes to human decency, then the halacha has a very different view of our relation to non-Jew. And the Gemara in Gittin, it's actually two pages after the famous stories of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, all the discussions of the Gemara many of the discussions of the Talmud on the destruction of the temple are in Masechet Gittin. And as we pointed out, that's not a coincidence. A get is the separation of a man and a woman. And of course, that's symbolic, the separation of God and the Jewish people. When God exiled us, that's the separation, the get. God wrote us, Ezu Sefer Kritut. God wrote us he divorced us, so to speak. And that happens to be in the chapter of Darche Shalom. If you learn Masechet Gittin, which talks about the laws, it talks about, like all tractates, usually talks about much more than its central theme. Much of it talks about documents in general. And it talks about, of course, the what we call a get, a divorce document. But there are two chapters that have all these laws of Darche Shalom, of things we do to promote peace. So the most famous one is we give the Kohen the first Aliyah, because otherwise you'll have fights in shuls. How many Kohanim? There are three Kohanim in shul. Okay, so they take turns every third week, or one Monday, Thursday, Shabbos. So you take turns, you get Aliyahs all the time. There are 300 Yisraelim, so they're going to fight. So we give, everybody wants the first Aliyah. It's very sad, but that's the reality of life. So Mipnei Darche Shalom. And the Gemara has a lot of laws that Mipnei Darche Shalom. It's in those chapters, not coincidentally, that the Gemara discusses the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, the stories of the temple, the destruction, which was, you know, the opposite of Darche Shalom, the opposite of the peace way. So in that chapter, the Gemara discusses giving stuff to non-Jews, and then maybe they're going to use it for inappropriate purposes. Let's have the discussion today, giving a non-observant Jew. If you give him, can you give your non-observant Jew, can you give a non-observant Jew a tractor that he's going to use in the Shemitah year? Because you're helping him to say, oh, whatever. So that's the whole discussion about that. So it's there that the Gemara says, Mefarnesim ani akum imina Yisrael. One ani akum. Now, akum is the term for ovde kochavim umazala, those who worship the stars. Like real, when you talk about idolatry, you know, we say the Christians today, that's not idolatry. The Muslims, not idolatry. This word akum is idolatry, worshiping the stars. So the Gemara says we have to give charity to idolaters. We don't like idolatry. The Torah takes a very harsh view. Sefer Dvarim is basically a book against idolatry. It's just, that's the major theme. That's why Shema is in Sefer Dvarim, right? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad appears in Sefer Dvarim because we reject idolatry. We have one God. And what does Moshe do? The whole book is about don't follow the ways of the Gentiles, don't follow the ways of the seven nations in Israel. The laws of intermarriage is next week's parsha, can't intermarry. The whole book of Dvarim is don't follow, don't do avodah zarah. That's really so much of the book is about it. So we have to relate to it in slightly different ways. And yet, someone is an idol worshiper and is in need of food, you have to give him. The Gemara says you have to feed him, you have to give him clothing, you have to bury his dead, you have to mourn with him, you have to go pay quote unquote a shiva visit to your non-Jewish, to the priest, your next door neighbor who happens to be a priest, whatever. So he's on these take whatever branch religion you want to think of that worships really idols. So that the Gemara says you still have to be close to them, or not, you have to help them a lot. So I find this a fascinating idea. We don't like distinctions like this. In other words, it's a very sharp distinction. Socially, they touch your wine, you can't drink it. But on a human level, we have to help them. We have to give them charity, etc. I believe, if I remember correctly now, you know, Mark Shapiro pointed out, I think a few times, the Mata Levi, that's Horowitz, Rabbi Horowitz. I forget his first name now. He was the rabbi of the main quote unquote Orthodox shul in Berlin, a block away from Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's shul. You know, like Shimshon Raphael Hirsch broke away from the whole community, Ostrich. You know, we can't have anything because the community was controlled by the Reform. The Reform would give money to the Orthodox. That was a big debate. It's not for now, but Hirsch was in the minority. Today he's the majority, but at the time Hirsch was in the minority, and Hirsch seceded from the general Jewish community to create his own community. So they had the and they were basically a cherem on that shul. Anybody from Hirsch's shul, you could not walk into that shul. That was like, it was an Orthodox shul. It's an Orthodox shul, but they believed you could work with the reform on a communal level. There was a big fights in Germany and Hungary, unfortunately, in the 19th century. We haven't recovered yet from those fights. They're still going on, hurting us, I believe. But anyway, so Rabbi Horowitz was the rabbi of the shul at the same time that Rav Hirsch was a much larger shul. They had more people than Rav Hirsch was the rabbi. Rav Hirsch was a fiery leader, a tremendous orator, a tremendous leader, and everything. And he, I believe, has a tshuva. I have to look at inside that a church. There was a fire in a church, and they were asked whether the Jews could give money to help rebuild the church, and he said yes. Now that's a little startling. That's not the same thing as a member of the church who lost his job and there's no welfare there, and we got to help him. This is already one step up. But Darchei Shalom, I don't know if I did. I may have once mentioned the story of Rabbi Charlap when I was in Yeshiva University. Rabbi Charlap, I hope he should do well. He was the director of the Smicha program of Reitz when I was in Yeshiva University. So he told us a story once. It was very cute he was friendly with. He was the rabbi for many years in the Bronx, and he was friendly with the church, the priest of the church. So one day the priest saw Rabbi Charlap. He invited him. They were rededicating the church. They did a renovation. They're having like a lahavdil, a Chanukah bayit to celebrate the dedication of the church. So he invited Rabbi Charlap. No. A Jew walking to a church, they go to a church service, that's not something the head of the rabbinical school is going to want to do. Jonathan Sachs, Zal would talk about these things. He would go to the church if the Queen of England invited him, but he wouldn't go if the Parliament invited him for Shalom Malchut. It's a very interesting distinction he thought he's made. If the invitation came from the Queen, he would go. If the invitation came from Boris Johnson or whatever before Blair, and he wouldn't go. That's a whole different thing. Anyway, so he didn't want to insult him. What are they going to tell him? I don't go to churches against my religion. It's very not nice. That's as hard as saying, but if you touch my wine, I won't drink it. You can't tell that to somebody. So he said, I'm going to be, when is it? I'm going to be in California. So of course that wasn't true. He just made it up. So he came home and he felt bad, and he bought a ticket to go to California. And he said, I told him I'm going to be in California. I can't lie. So he's going to California. His wife said, why don't you say you're going to be in Boston? But why do you have to say you're going to be in California? But I think it's a beautiful story, a beautiful story. It's a Dover Shalom, Dover Amet Bilvavo. You speak the truth. If I say I'm going to be in California, you go, it's okay. So then he has an excuse not to go. But whatever it is, so those are interesting questions. Where do we draw the line today in our relation? But having Makdim Shalom L'chol Adam, for sure be nice. I've often mentioned the story. It's, I believe, in Jonathan Rosenblum's book on Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. I've mentioned many times that he lived near a convent, right? That's what it's called, the nuns in Muncie. And after he died, the nuns came to pay a shiva visit on the Kamenetsky family. Apparently, Rav Yaakov was very friendly with them. And one of the nuns complained that he was the only person who would say hello to them. Like all the yeshiva boys, you know, they saw a nun, I'm going to talk. And Rav Yaakov would greet him, how are you? You know, very nice. So it is the halach, I think, is much more broad than sometimes we think it is. But anyway, so that's the Gemara. Heavy Makdim Shalom L'chol Adam Afilu Nochru Shebashuk. Of course, on a more practical level, I don't think we have these issues today. Of course, I mean, normal people, nice people say hello to everybody. Of course, Afilu Nochru Shebashuk, even the non-Jew in the marketplace. So of course, what this means is being nice in the marketplace. In other words, he could have said, Rav Yochanan Ben Zakkai, nobody said hello to him first, even the non-Jew, even the idolater in the marketplace. Well, what about in the market? Who cares if he's in the marketplace? Even the idolater, he said hi to first. But it means in the marketplace, you know, people are not so nice. The rough and tumble of the market, yes. You know. So Rav Yochanan Ben Zakkai, even the, you have to take your, it's not all business. It's not all about making money. Take your time to greet people, even in the rough and tough, you know, people are very busy. They have the story of Yisrael Salanter once. They tell the story that he was walking to Shul on Yom Kippur, or Erev Yom Kippur, I hope I remember the story, and he came and he said hello to some Jew, and the Jew didn't answer him. So he sort of, why didn't he answer? So he said, no, he was thinking about doing, you know, tshuva. He was so engrossed in his thoughts, walking to shul on Yom Kippur, I had to do tshuva. So Rabbi Yosef Salanter said, because he sinned, I have to suffer. So what? If he sinned, that's no excuse not to say hello to somebody. We get caught up in all our things. One of the most beautiful halachot is that you can say hello to somebody in the middle of Kriyat Shema. I don't know how people observe this anymore today. The second chapter in Masech Berakot is all the details. Details, how much of it, can you initiate the conversation? The answer depends where you are in the Shema. You're in the middle of the paragraph, in between, before Vayam Shamoa. In between the chapters, you can say more, but the Gemara is very clear. You can for sure at least respond. It may depend who the person is, if it's a parent, a teacher, or just, you know, some whatever. But yes, the fact that you can interrupt the Shema to greet people tells you it's pretty important. The fact that Avraham Avinu could interrupt God, and when God, oh, I see three Arabs on the street. I remember, right, what does the Medrash say? He made him wash his feet because they were idol worshippers. So he didn't want to bring the idol worship into his house. But the idol worshippers he wanted to bring to his house. He just didn't want the idol worship in his house. So, and he interrupts God. God, there are a few people worshiping idols. You know what you tell us not to do? Like, there are people, they don't believe in you. But I have to, God, I can talk to you later. But come, let me go meet the people. So these are things, we all know this. We all have learned this, but we don't take it to heart. And of course, being Erev Tisha B'Av, everybody knows one of the most famous halachot on Tisha B'Av is you can't greet people. Can't say Sheilat Shalom. So first, so we know the old joke, and it's not always a joke. People are machmir all year. They are afraid they may, if they say hello during the year, they're afraid they may by mistake say hello on Tisha B'Av. So they have a rule, they never say hello to people. That they shouldn't, God forbid, say hello to somebody on Tisha B'Av. So this is, first of all, it tells you how important it is to say hello. The fact that there's a halacha, you can't say hello. This most important part, and I wish more people would point this out, unless I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. Sheilat Shalom, you can't greet people on Tisha B'Av, does not mean good morning. That's not what it means. I personally believe there's absolutely no problem saying good morning to somebody. Maybe I'm crazy, but Sheilat Shalom, if you look in the Gemara, Sheilat Shalom does, Sheilat Shalom, even the words, I didn't say, heavy makti, a Sheilat Shalom means I ask about you. Sheilat Shalom is how are you doing? How's the family? Do you have any problems? How are you managing in COVID? You know, how the kids doing? How are they managing the mortgage payments? They can't buy a house in the crazy market, you know. Like Sheilat Shalom means how are you doing? It's not say hello. You know, I always joke. I mean, you go to shul on Tisha B'Av night, so everybody knows you can't say hello to people. So nobody says hello to people, but they sit in the hall after keynote for 20 minutes, schmoozing, discussing, you know. So that's what you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to have friendly conversation. That's very hard. It's very hard not to have friendly conversation with people. If you're a normal person and you see people, we're doing this program on Sunday online for 8 hours. So I did this program for 20 years in Toronto live. I would do keynote explanations in the morning for 3 hours, you know, whoever selected keynote. And then we would go in the afternoon, have five speakers back to back. There were literally people I would see once a year. They would come to our teacher program. I never would see them. You know, people are busy. So that's very hard. When I'm not going to say hello, I'm not going to talk to them. I don't know. So maybe I violated this halacha a little bit. It's like the Rogachover famously said when he was, they tell the story about a few people. He was sitting shiva and he was learning Torah. So they told him, you can't, everybody knows, you can't learn Torah when you're sitting shiva. He said, no, what can I do? I can't exist. So I'm willing to sin. I'm willing to get punished for this sin of to learn Torah. Halavai, that the worst sin a person does is they learn Torah on Tisha B'Av. That story, by the way, was censored out of when they published the book. It was in, I think, the original, then they censored it out. Because, you know, it means the Rogachover was saying it's okay to violate halacha, whatever you want to make of the story. But Sheilat Shalom doesn't mean you can't say, I don't believe it means can't say hello to people. It means you're not supposed to schmooze. That's what the halacha is saying, Makdim Shalom. It's not to say good morning first. So yes, that's important to say good morning, but it's not about good morning. It's about much more than that. Anyways, that's a little bit about... what the Mishnah is having Makdim Shalom Cholam. We know this, but you should say if you can interrupt the Shema, you can interrupt the conversation you're having with your friend when you're walking to shul and you pass somebody, to take half a second and say good Shabbos, and even say, how are you doing? You know, okay, most people today, if they're not interested, they're not interested. But okay, that's that Mishnah. Let's move on, unless anybody has any questions. Somebody pointed that Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said hello to everyone first. Metaphor, he looked ahead to see what was coming. Okay, I mean, that's Haroet HaNolad. I'm not sure he looked ahead to see what was coming. He said hello. I'm not sure the connection exactly, but Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai clearly had foresight. That's why he gave up Jerusalem in order to save the Jewish people. Right? Most people just looked at the moment. The Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai understood. No. Let's restart in Yavne. Somebody asked me privately if God divorced the Jewish people, then what ketuvah did he pay out? So it's a funny question, of course. It's not, obviously, I don't know that we have to take it so on that level. But I will say, if you want a halachic answer, I'll give you a halachic answer. The Mishnah in Ketuvah, it says that if, let's say, a woman or a man commits adultery, so the spouse can demands a divorce. And let's say if the woman commits adultery and her husband divorces her, she doesn't get paid her ksuba. The Mishnah, if the wife feeds the husband non-kosher food, he doesn't have to pay the ksuba. If the husband becomes not religious, whatever, the husband's abusive, so the wife can demand the divorce and the wife gets her ksuba. But if you're at fault in the marriage, you lose your ksuba. So the real answer is God divorced the Jewish people. They didn't have to pay the ksuba because it was based on our wrongdoing. So if we sin, you can divorce the spouse without paying the ksuba. But I don't want to go that far. But I think the real thing is, no, what did God pay? He came with us. Imo Anochi Betzara. God came with us to the exile. He exiled himself. God suffers. That's what it's heretical to say. But that's what our tradition teaches, that God is exiled and God is suffering with the Jewish people. That's a very Kabbalistic notion. And God needs the Jewish people to do mitzvot in order to help him. And God cries. When I said before, God cries three tears because people who are in leadership and shouldn't be in leadership. That means God is suffering, whatever that idea means. So God accompanied us into exile. I mentioned that Rav Schachter, in his article on the mitzvah to live in Israel, quotes that maybe that's only true until God said, okay, I'm going back to Israel, until 1948. I don't know, whatever year you want to put it at. But God said, oh, yes, I'll accompany the exile. But God said, exile's over. Everybody can go back to Israel now. We have a modern state of Israel. We have a law of return. Even in COVID, you can make Aliyah. All the restrictions, I think, about going to Israel are only if you're coming as an American or a Canadian. But if you want to make Aliyah, they let you in. The COVID, no COVID. Any Jew can make Aliyah. Maybe it's hard to get flights sometimes. But maybe God, the exile is over. So God went back to Israel. He didn't accompany us to exile. Rav Schachter writes, that's a little bit of a frightening thought. In other words, whatever, you know, that God for 2,000 years, okay, it's hard for us to relate to these things because we're going to say we're going to argue for good reason. What we've had it now better in the exile than we ever had it in our history. When God accompanied that, we had Holocaust, all these terrible things. Okay, God went back, but life is wonderful in the diaspora. So it's a little bit hard for us to relate to these concepts. But that's the rabbis understood that God didn't just exile the Jewish people. God's bound up with the Jewish people. And as we went into exile, God went into exile with us, whether he had to pay us our ksuva or didn't have to pay us our ksuva. Okay. Next Mishnah, Tet Zayin 16, Rabbi Yaakov Omer, Ha'olam hazeh domeh l'pruzdor b'fnei olam haba. This world is like an antechamber, a pruzdor. It's a Greek word. B'fnei olam haba. Hatkein otzmecha b'pruzdor. Prepare yourself in the pruzdor, in the antechamber, kadesha ki kanesh the truckling, so you can enter into the palace. So this, in other words, this world is the preparation for the world to come. So this also is a lot of things that it's very hard for us to relate to. The Torah basically says nothing about the world to come. Nothing. Where does Torah say anything about it? Torah doesn't say anything about resurrection of the dead. Torah doesn't even say anything about the Messianic era. Torah doesn't say anything about any of these things. That's why the Mishnah in Sanhedrin has to sort of define, you know, a non-believer is one who doesn't believe in these things. In other words, a Jew who doesn't believe, okay, maybe today it's a little bit different, but let's say for the Jews who left Egypt. So what are you going to tell me? You have to believe God took you out of Egypt. That's like, what do you have to believe? They left Egypt. They know. They don't have to believe that. I mean, you only have to believe things that you can't prove 100%. That's a whole interesting question on the notion of belief in God. What does that mitzvah mean? But, you know, how much faith does it require? Can you argue that beliefs can be proven or not? But the Torah mentions nothing because the Torah's concern is not, as we'll see really in the next mission, the Torah doesn't really care about the next world. The Torah doesn't care about the Messianic age. The Torah cares that we make this world a better place, that we live up to our duties in this world. So everything in the Torah is this world related. All the rewards promised in the Torah, it'll rain at the proper time, you know, have nice kids, your animals will be productive. Look, the blessings of the Torah are very mundane. They're very mundane. You'll be, you know, you'll have nice homes. You'll, everything will go smoothly. But there's no spiritual blessings in the Torah. The Torah is a very, very physical book. The Torah, that's when Moshe went up to the heavens, right? And God said, why are you giving the Torah? The angel said, don't give the Torah to Moshe. And Moshe had to respond. We discussed this. So all the responses of Moshe, there you know, don't steal. Well, you guys don't go to work. Honor your parents. You guys don't have parents. In other words, the whole Torah is meant for the physical world. That's what we need the Torah. You don't need the Torah in heaven. There's no Torah in heaven. Torah lo b'shamayim, right? There's no the Torah is here. So everything about the Torah is very this world oriented. There is nothing about the world to come or Messianic era. Nonetheless, that became, especially in the way as the Rambam described, became very, very central to our belief, although there's very little discussion about it in the Talmud. Again, the Talmud, the rabbis were very concerned with practical issues. We mentioned last week, that's why there's no Talmud on Zrayim and on Tara. The rabbis didn't discuss the laws of agriculture in Babylonia. They were not relevant. They didn't discuss it. But here you have this notion that ultimately this world is just a preparation for the next world. I kind of like to say, like, maybe like, you know, the guy who hits, you know, you're 400 in March, you know, if I remember, if I'm giving too many baseball analogies, you can let me know, but you can just put in the chat, if you like baseball, you can let me know too. But George Steinbrenner, who was the owner of the Yankees, I'm sure people remember, you know, years ago, and quite a, you know, a personality of an owner. So I believe he called Dave Winfield Mr. March. I don't know if you know, Reggie Jackson hit 3 home runs against the Dodgers in the 77 World Series. And they won the World Series. He got the nickname, you know, Mr. October. October is when they play the World Series. So that in the clutch, he's the best player in the clutch. Dave Winfield then was signed. George Steinbrenner paid him a lot of money. He wasn't playing well. So he called him Mr. March. So March is the exhibition season. Before they play 25 games. They get ready. The games don't count, but the players have to practice. So he said, yeah, and in March, Dave Winfield is a great hitter, but Mr. March. Anyways, so that's like if you don't like my analogy, I'm sorry. But so that's like, this world is like, is March. It's the exhibition season. The what really counts is, this is just the place you prepare to enter into the next world. But anyway, so as the Gemara puts it, whoever prepares on Erev Shabbat will eat on Shabbat. And we know how Shabbat is Me'ein Olam Haba. That's the Gemara in the beginning of, interesting, Avodah Zarah, in the tractate dealing with the laws of idolatry. So the tractate opens up with the non-Jewish nations complaining to God about God's will ultimately take out his vengeance on Rome. And the Greeks come to God and the Romans come and every nation comes to say all the wonderful things they did on behalf of the Jewish people. And God, that's one Gemara, but here in Avodah Zarah, they're being judged harshly by God. So the nations of the world say to God, you know what? Give us another chance. Give us the Torah. You know, it's sort of allusions to the Medrash that they were once offered the Torah and they turned it down. So they said, give us a second chance. So God answers, no, whoever eats an Erev Shabbos, whoever prepares an Erev Shabbos will eat on Shabbat. Once you get to the world to come, as I say, we take only receipts. You can't, can't write a check for the charity you didn't give in this world. And to get to the next world, the receipts you can take with you, but your checkbook not ain't going to do you any good. So God said to the nations, whoever eats, whoever prepares on Friday will eat on Shabbat. But then God says, you know what? I'm a nice God. I'll give you a second chance. It's amazing. Gemara says, I have a mitzvah kala. I have a really easy mitzvah for you. Let's see what happens. Here's the mitzvah. You know what? Anybody know what mitzvah God then gave to the nations of the world, according to this Gemara, to observe? Anybody haven't learned of Avodah Zarah? If you want to guess, what's an easy mitzvah? What would you call an easy mitzvah?
Sukkah.
Very good. Sukkah. Very good. So the Gemara says, here's the mitzvah of sukkah. Go build a sukkah. So the Gemara says, whatever this means, they go build the sukkah. So God's not so nice. He makes it really, really hot, and it's a thunderstorm, whatever. The weather is horrendous. So the non-Jews said, that sukkah, they're ridiculous. I sit in a sukkah. Are you crazy? And they go to the, they kick the sukkah and they go inside. And so God says, you see, I gave you a mitzvah and you wouldn't even keep it. The Lord says, what are you talking about? When it rains, even a Jew doesn't have to sit in the sukkah. Well, what are they? They knew anything wrong. When the weather's really bad, you don't eat in the sukkah. So the angels say, no, but okay, you leave the sukkah because you're sad. In other words, I'm very upset I can't eat in the sukkah. The non-Jews, as the Gemara said, they kicked the sukkah. I get this stupid sukkah away from me. So that's the attitude that they have, which is also a very important idea, that sometimes the attitude towards mitzvah is much more important than the mitzvah itself. Mm-hmm. So that was what the Gemara said. Now, what's the imagery? So first of all, many know, we just started learning, sukkah and Daf Yomi. Last week we started Daf Yomi, but of course the imagery is very beautiful, because what's the sukkah? What's a sukkah? Sukkah is a temporary home. We leave our home, and it's to remind ourselves that light, that's how the Rashbam, that's how many explain. The sukkah reminds ourselves that life is temporary. Like I just wrote about that this week in the piece I sent out on Daf Yomi on sukkah. Life is temporary and it's unstable. And so that's exactly what God was telling us. The sukkah, in a sense, represents this world, which is unprotected. But we're open to the elements. And the home represents the bayit, represents really the, olam haba, in a sense. So Gemara, God was telling the non-Jewish world, the sukkah represents how do you prepare yourself in this world to enter into the next world. But that's what the Gemara says. Hatken atzmah ha'olam hazeh domeh l'pruzder. It's this world is only an antechamber of the world to come. It's a very, Okay, that's now we have to prepare in this world in order to go, because as the next mission is going to say, you can't do mitzvot. Like I just said, you can't bring your checkbook into Olam Haba. Now, the Tiferet Yisrael very explains very, very beautiful. The imagery, the word, the Mishnah could have said, Rabbi Yaakov could have said, prepare yourself in this world. A truckline is a palace, a fancy palace. So he said, first of all, what's a waiting room? You go to the doctor, and the doctor says, okay, the doctor's busy. He'll see you in a few moments. So you sit there. So sometimes you sit there for 3 minutes and sometimes you sit there for an hour. The waiting room is a place where you have no idea when they're going to call you in. So that's the Tiferet Yisrael explains. That's how we have to view our life. Shuv yom atchad lifnei mitatcha. Repent one day before you die. We never know when we're going to die, right? We sit in the waiting room, but anybody can be called from the waiting room at any moment. And we all know that it's not always on the order of how you got there. I'm sure you've all been to places where you've sat down and somebody walks in later than you, gets called in early, and you're thinking, well, that's not fair. I got here first. Why is he going in before me? So that's the imagery. That's how the Tiferet Yisrael explained the imagery of the waiting room and the palace. The palace is the world to come. The waiting room is this world. And God can call you at any moment. So we better always be ready, prepared. At the same time, again, this is a dual, to think that, to think about death all the time is depressing. It's not healthy. It's not good. We have an expression in Talmud, lo chayshin on the mita. We're not afraid. People drop dead. What does that mean? It's a halachic concept. It means like this. We're talking on Gittin here. Somebody sends a divorce document. The first Mishnah in Masechet Gittin is Hamevi Get Medinat Hayam. somebody brings a get from America, okay, not really America, Europe, whatever, brings a get across the from the Mediterranean. No, they didn't have travel. It takes 3 weeks, 3 weeks, 3 months. A person went on a trip, on a business trip, and a year later decides to divorce his wife. So he goes to the court, and the court arranges, and they send the get. Some messenger travels the Atlantic for 3 months, and they give the get to the wife. Now, how do you know the wife? How do you know the husband is still alive? Maybe he died. He can't call up. We don't worry about things like that. We don't worry people are going to die. Yeah, of course, everybody's going to die eventually. So, Gemara, again, what are the limits? But it's much more than that. It's you can't live your life always thinking you're going to die. It's not, yes. So on the one hand, do tshuva the day before you die. Again, we have this dialectic. We always, I discussed this much more a lot, you know, last year. We always have these contradictory motifs. On the one hand, always being prepared that you're going to get called in from the waiting room. On the other hand, that's like, you can't live like that. Just live your life. Don't worry about your lo chashin and limita. We don't worry. And the Gemara says, if the Yetzer Hara wants to get you, so you say Shema, you go to the base medrash, only afterwards you think of the day of death. That's the last resort. The custom to say Yisker on Yontov is a very difficult custom. We don't, right on Yom Kippur, it ruins the Yontov. Who wants to think about that, right? We have limits to our mourning. But and I also think that ties into the idea of a palace. In other words, we're preparing the palace also, in other words, we're in the antechamber, but of a house, whoa, we're marveling at the marble and the artwork and the beauty and the grandeur of everything that we're supposed to enjoy this world. And don't worry every second what's going to be. You're supposed to enjoy the world. That's what the Gemara, the Yerushalmi says, that one of the questions God will ask us at 120 is, I made a beautiful world. Did you enjoy it? Right? That's God put us here to enjoy the world. We eat the fruit, right? We have a notion of a Suda Mitzvah. According to the Torah, we fast one day a year, Yom Kippur, okay, Tisha B'Av. Now we fast, okay, 6 days a year. 359 days a year, it's eat. Eat with Hashem B'Simcha would be in joy. Thinking of death is not joyful. It's not joyful. So we have this tension. On the one hand, I would say we have to have it in our subconscious where we want to sing and when we want to sin to remind yourself what can be and how we live our life. It also can be, of course, this is always a personality thing. You know, different people, what gets them to work are different things. Some people, it's like we discussed a number of times, you know, in Slobodka or Nevordic, you want to tell a person not to sin. Do you tell them how great he is or how terrible he is? So if you tell them how great he is, then you're so great. I expect more from you. You're such a wonderful person. You let us down here. I know you can do better. That's a very different thing. Then you sinner, you're a nobody. Why do you sin? We don't want you to be like that. Get better. So now, I think in our generation, that second approach doesn't work so well. But I think often it did work. And for many people, that the first approach, I'm a great guy. So, okay, I sin a little bit. What do you want from me? I'm great. Okay, you know what? I am not always going to be like that. So it can be different approaches. And that's really the next Mishnah. We'll just introduce the next Mishnah. Hu Haya Omer, Rav Yaakov says, this is, and we'll have to, maybe we'll leave it with the contradiction and see how to resolve the contradiction. It's better or it's more pleasant. 1 hour of tshuva, of repentance, umasim tovim, and good deeds in this world, mikol chayei olam haba, from all the next world. Forget the next world. Seems to be contradicting himself, right? He just said, prepare yourself for this world. It's better, 1 hour of a meaningful life is better than the entire world to come. Now, we, according to in Jewish thought, sort of, the world to come is eternal, whatever that means, right? The Rambam says, there's no time in the world to come. That's why we can't relate to it. So, but better 1 hour of good living in this world, mikol chayei olam haba. It's better than the next world. Forget that's this world. We cry when the people die, right? We want the opportunity to do mitzvot in this world. We can't do that in the next world. So yapeh shachat, better 1 hour. And then he says, no, it sounds like the exact opposite. Yapeh shachat shokort ruach olam haba. But better 1 hour of korat ruach, of rest and relaxation in the next world, mikoch haye olam haba. But 1 hour in the world to come, a rest is better than all of life in this world. Which is it? Isn't this a blatant contradiction? On the one hand, this world, 1 hour in this world is better than the entire world to come. And on the other hand, 1 hour in the world to come is better than this entire world. So what's going on here? Any ideas? I ask because I don't have any ideas. So I want to hear from you, right? So what's going on here? So I think some of the commentators go in this idea. This world and the next world are like apples and oranges. There's nothing to compare. They're two totally different worlds. This is the world of physicality. This is the world of action. And in other words, from this world's perspective, the next world is meaningless. But in the next world, I don't know that this answers. I'm just saying it's very hard, right? The next world, the world to come is a spiritual world. In a spiritual world, physical rewards are meaningless. And in the physical world, like spiritual rewards are meaningless. In other words, each world has its own thing. Or maybe I'll give a bad example, but it's one I thought. Like you give somebody a prize of Australian dollars in Canada, it isn't worth very much. It's not legal tender. Okay, I can go to the bank and switch it. Leave that aside. Right? Ancient world, you have Australian dollars here. They're not going to do me any good. And Canadian dollars aren't going to do any good unless your Canadian dollars aren't even going to do any good in the United States, let alone in Australia. In other words, each place has its own reward. I know that's kind of takes away from the PowerPoint he's saying, but this world and the next world are not in conflict. They're two totally different worlds. And therefore, what's great for one world is much more meaningful than the rest of a little bit of one world is better than the whole other world on that issue. Maybe I know that's, I don't even know if I understand what I'm saying exactly, but that's, I think, the idea. They're complementary. Let me just say one last thing, and maybe we'll have to pick up on this next week. It's kind of the idea that I'll just say very quickly, When Rivka is pregnant with Yaakov and Esav, so Rashi quotes the Medrash when she walked by a church, right? Esav wanted to get it, and when she walked by a synagogue, it's an anachronistic Midrash, of course. She walked by a shul, Yaakov wanted to get out, and I think Rashi there quotes that they're arguing. Yaakov wanted Olam Haba, and Esav wanted Olam Hazeh. So the question of Farshim asks is, so there's no fight. There's no fight. Give Yaakov Olam Haba and give Esav Olam Hazeh. What are they fighting about? But you see right there that the Mefarshim understand that Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba are two totally different worlds. Well, what do you mean? I want a world where I think about spiritual goals. My goals are not to make money or whatever. It's just to get by or whatever it is. So, but we'll pick up on this, please God, a little bit next week. But you can think about it. It's not easy. On the one hand, this world is better than the next world. And on the other hand, the next world is better than this world. So which is it? So we can think about that. I have a little bit more to say. But if you have anything to say, I'd love to hear your thoughts. So just let's quickly review what we did so far. We spoke about the fox and the lion, that we shouldn't be like a fox, but we should be like a lion. The fox is sly, and unfortunately, many leaders get to their positions through their slyness and their inappropriateness for their position. And that's the quote verse that the Rambam quotes about being like the foxes are ruining the vineyards. So we should put ourselves part of the line. The importance of saying hello to people, and hello is more than hello. It's Shaylat Shalom. To say hello, I think on Tisha B'Av you're okay. You have my permission. Not that the world wants only my permission, but you know. But it's the greeting. It's the schmoozing with people on Tisha B'Av. That's inappropriate. But Shaylat Shalom is very important. That's the greatness of Rav Yochanan Ben Zakkai. Adam. We don't care if they're idolaters. We welcome everybody into to bring a sacrifice. Adam ki akriv. We have to help them when they're poor, and we have to bury their dead, and we have to clothe them when they're needy. Yes, on the social side, we have a wall, an iron wall. If they touch our wine, we don't drink it. So that's a wall that's hard for us in our generation. But that's a distinction the halacha seems to make, but the importance of being respectful to all and greeting all and saying all and inviting the priest to your home and, you know, etc., and greeting them and saying hi to the nuns, etc. And then we discussed this world and the next world, preparing an Erev Shabbos for Shabbos, and the notion of the non-Jewish world wanting the opportunity to get a second chance. Really, there are no second chances once you get to the next world. All the second chance you have to prepare on Erev Shabbat, so you can eat on Shabbat, which is the world to come. And that's the imagery of the sukkah, represents that link between this world and the next world. We leave our home, we leave our safety, and this world, we're out to the elements, and we kick away the sukkah, and then we come to the permanent world. Then we have to pick up is which world is greater, this world or the next world. The next world's hard for us to relate to, but the Mishnah seems to contradict itself, which maybe that's the answer. Maybe there's just a contradiction. Okay, if any questions, people can feel free to unmute themselves. I think there is one question, one comment here, one we did before. And mention, of course, our Tisha B'Av program on Sunday beginning at 11 a.m., Shuli Mishkan, 8 hours, okay? If anybody want to take me up on my offer, come for 8 hours and we send you Uber Eats, right, to break the fast. Okay, this world the next ties in, there's a private Talmudic discussion. Is it better than men being created or not? The Talmud says it's better not to be created, but since you are created in this world, this is how to act. Aha. So you want to say that really the next world, for most people, this world isn't so good because we shouldn't have been created. I don't know. I have to think about that. The Talmud, Tosfot there does say that when the Gemara says, first of all, I'm not sure the Talmud says it means better not to be created. I actually don't think that's what the Gemara means. That's what everybody says it means. But if you look in the Gemara, you have to look. It says Noach lo la'adam. The discussion isn't Yafeh. It's a good Yafeh Talmud Torah Derech. It's nice. It's good. Yafeh Sha'achad. It's good. 1 hour in this world better than the whole world to come. The Gemara doesn't say Yafeh Shenivra or Yafeh Shalom Nivra. It's good that now, or Tov Shenivra. That would be a better word. The Gemara doesn't say this debate between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, is it better that man was created? For 3 years they debated this subject. But the discussion, no, that's not the debate. The debate doesn't say Tov, it says Noach. Is it comfortable to have been created? It's good to have been created, but it's life. Life isn't always Noach. Life isn't always comfortable. Life is made up. It's, in other words, are we happy? Not that weather was good, but does life allow contentment? Minucha, right? I always like to say people that Avraham is the first Jew, right? Noach, it can't be the first Jew. Why? Because he's Noach. Noach means to rest and relax. A Jew can't rest and relax. When do we meet Avraham? Lech Lecha. Get on the move. A Jew's always on the move. Halacha means move. That's why this is a Zoom broadcast of Torah in motion. Torah is always on the move. Halacha means to move. Noach, rest and relax. That's what the Medrash gets mad at Yaakov Abinu. He wanted to rest after all his trials and tribulations with Esav and Laban before Yosef. By Yeshiv Yaakov, Be'eris Megurei Aviv. He wanted to retire in the Negev, have a nice life. And God said, what, are you crazy? The next world, Olam Haba, is when you retire. Olam Hazeh, now your life is going to start. So the word Noach has an idea of rest and relaxation and not working hard. So the debate, Noach lo ladam, is not whether it was good if man was created, meaning does life offer us contentment or not? And where it says that's not the role of life. The role of life is not that you should have minuchah. That's the Gorge of the Gemara. And how can you do it? It's just how I interpret the Gemara. Yefashfesh from Asab, examine your ways. We were created. Life isn't always pleasant, but if you examine your ways, life is meaningful. Pleasant and meaningful is not always the same thing. Often you do what's right. It's not pleasant. You can lose your job. You speak up, you do something right. It can be very costly to you. You lose friends, but you feel good about yourself. You feel safe about yourself. So I don't think, how can we say that wasn't good that man was created? God created us. What God this by Yarl Himet Kol Asher Asah B'nei Tov Mo'ad. The word of creation is Tov. Ki Tov, 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 Tov. On the sixth day, when God created man, it's Tov Mo'ad. It's very good. So you cannot say that this debate is a good for man created means that just isn't true. I don't believe it's true. I have to read the Gemara very carefully. Unfortunately, that's become very common. People they don't look at the Gemara like carefully. So they say, Beit Shammai, they'll argue, was it good for man created? No, of course it was good man was created. Was it Noach? Are we meant to have a comfortable life? So that was the debate. And the answer is no. Life is not meant to be comfortable. This is not popular, but it's not going to get you in the Kiruv movement. You know, like in other words, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I shouldn't say it. I don't know, but that usually doesn't stop me. But the modern Orthodox world is never being strong on Kiruv, and I think part of it is that's not what they do. It's not, even though the first Kiruv was in the modern Orthodox world, JSS at Yeshiva University, but Rav Soloveitchik's view of religion is religion should, you know, with the famous stand, what is it? It makes the comfortable uncomfortable and the uncomfortable, it comforts the non-comforted, whatever. So the role of Judaism is to put like needles under you to keep working. It's not something people want to hear necessarily. You want to hear if you keep Shabbos, you'll have a wonderful life, and keeping kosher, you keep the laws of Judaism Friday night, you'll have a beautiful family life. Not like the non-Jews out there have again, no meaning in life just with their computers, but we have a beautiful life. That's not the approach that I was brought up, and not the approach of Rav Soloveitchik, not the modern Orthodox world. That's not the goal in life, to have it's beautiful. Of course we want that. But the goal, the purpose of religion is not to make your life comfortable. And, so that doesn't sell as well. To tell that the purpose of life is to, you're not going to have rest. You want to be like Yaakovina and rest. Oh, God got angry. Yeah, you think you had a hard life now. Here comes Yosef. Now, trials play. Now the real problems start. It's a very, we don't like to hear it. We live in a generation. We're all like that. We like things comfortable. Of course it's good. We pray things should be good. We should be healthy. We should be wealthy. But that's not the goal of the Torah. And if the goal of the Torah is to make the world a better place the same way, not to get to the world to come with a reward. No, that's not it. It's to make this world a better place. The Takein Olam, the Malchut Shaddai. Okay, yeah. Is there an aspect of laziness? Absolutely. I think, and Noach basically, Noach was an Ich Tzadik Tamim. I don't like, you know, everybody, we criticize Noach. It's not fair. You know, Yesh Dorshim L'Gnai, right? The famous Rashi. Noach was a great guy, the Torah, but he didn't have what it took to be a Jew. After the flood, he was a broken man. He became an alcoholic. I mean, that's what it says. He planted grapes, Kerem. He planted grapes. I don't blame him. Believe me, if you had been in an ark with a bunch of animals for a year and there's no world and the world hasn't nothing left in the world, you'd go crazy. So he was Noah. He wanted a nice life. He wanted even the fact, you know, he didn't want to have kids. He waited to have kids. Kids, having a problem. Who needs kids? Kids is disruptive. It ruins my life. That's why he waited to 500. Right, to have kids. So Noach was right. He wanted a nice, pleasant life, and therefore he couldn't be Jewish. Avram didn't have such a pleasant life. He's going from place to place, and he's fighting, and he's preaching, and people think he's crazy, and he comes, and there's famine. And Yaakov had a really, really difficult life. They had very difficult lives, right? Yitzchak was a whole different story. So the goal of the Torah is not minucha, but it's kiddusha, it's sanctity. So I hope that answers the question. Maybe you didn't ask. Okay. Thank you. Anybody else want to? Zucker, yes. Okay. First, everybody want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom, and hopefully we'll see you on Tisha B'Av. I don't know, like we said at the beginning, I don't know if we call it looking forward, But nu, if life isn't supposed to be pleasant, Tisha B'Av is a great example of that. So, yes, Mr. Zucker, what would you like to ask?
Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, was it he who was saying once to his friend or student, you know, I'm terrified that after 120 years?
Yes, that's a beautiful, Rav Soloveitchik has a beautiful piece on that. Yes, I should have, that Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai on his deathbed was very nervous.
Yes, yes, that's amazing. This man who, according to you, saved Judaism. He was the one person.
Not according to me, according to history.
Yes, yes, and all his brother-in-law, did you say?
Right.
Lots of people, and yet he saved Judaism.
So Rav Soloveitchik has a beautiful piece, but this is also the not minucha. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai on his deathbed was very nervous, and his student said, why are you so nervous? He says, what are you talking about? He says, if I was going to have a judgment before a regular king, a human king, he's here today, gone tomorrow, I can bribe him, I can do whatever, I would be nervous. So now I'm going before the King of Kings. There's no bribery, there's no nothing. There are two gates open, and I don't know where I'm going. I shouldn't be nervous. So Rav Soloveitchik said, the Gemara has many stories. In Megillah, the Gemara has a whole section of stories of rabbis dying, and none of them were nervous. They, like, you know, it's part of life. They accepted it, and they did. And they tell, how come you had a long life? And I did this right, I did that right. A whole bunch of rabbis say, what were the things that granted them, they think, long life? So he asked, why was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai so nervous? So the Rav beautifully explains, yes, he saved Judaism, but he didn't know that. He thought he destroyed Judaism. He was nervous. He made the wrong decision. Great leaders always question what they're doing. Maybe I'm wrong, right? Our politicians don't think like that anymore, right? I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, Ed Koch's line. I love that line. The mayor of New York in the 80s or so, Ed Koch, when I was a student at GV University. So, you know, he was such a, what we call it, a real New Yorker, Ed Koch. So he said, you know, I have 12 policies. If you agree with me on 7 of the 12, you should vote for me. If you agree with me on 12 and 12, see a psychiatrist. Right. So great leaders are always questioning. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I made a mistake. So Yochanan ben Zakkai gave up Jerusalem. Wow. He let the temple be destroyed. And it's destroyed. And now he's in Yavne and he's dying. So, man, maybe I just made a terrible decision for Jewish history. And he was tormented. It's very sad. It's very tragic. But that's what Rav Soloveitchik explains. It's a beautiful, tragic story. Now, Rav Yochanan, that's my whole point. Life is not about being nice. It's about leadership. It's Noach. It's not Noach that being created. It's good. It's good. He did wonderful things. It's good to have been created, but it's not comfortable to have been created. So that's why Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai fear for his life, because he may fail. If you don't make any important decisions, so big deal, right? All decisions you should, but leadership, and we discussed in other times, every leader makes decisions that hurts people. By definition, a leader has to hurt people, otherwise he's no leader. But you just have to, right? And I always do this, right? Emunah, the stress that on with faithfulness. If you do your best, you do what, not because it's going to get you reelected. You're going to do because what's best for the most amount of people. Yeah, you're going to hurt people. That's what it means to be a leader. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, that's why he was tormented. And that makes him an even greater leader. And he didn't just questioned what he did. Right. Yes, I'm very good. Somebody pointing out to me, Brent, privately, that Yisrael means the struggle. Yaakov Avinu only becomes Yisrael when he struggles, when he has to fight with angels. We would not be here. There would be no B'nai Yisrael without a struggle. Thank you very much. Okay, everybody can go. I mean, you can go whenever you want. I can't. It's not like in the classroom, I can close the door. You know, I teach, can't leave the room. You know, on Zoom, come and go as you want. But everybody, want to wish you a Shabbat Shalom, and please God, we'll see you on Sunday. Then we have our regular Shirim, of course, all during the week next week, Monday, Shira Mervis on the Ben Ish Chai, I believe, you know, Islamic rabbis from the Islamic world, and followed by Alex Israel on the Lord Jonathan Sachs. And Tuesday is the last of Rachel Sharansky's, her series, her 8-part series on storytelling and the rights of kings. Wednesday is the last of Marty Lakshin's series on Pshat, Rush, and Halakha. And then Simi Peters on Yirmiyahu, the Haftorah of the week. And Thursday, Jonathan Ziering on Shemitah, as a lens into Torah and the Parsha Shir. And then next week, please God, Pirkei Avot. Okay, so everybody be well. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.